Found the gavel. Sorry about that. Good morning, good afternoon, and welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Gil Klein. I'm the vice president of the National Press Club and a national correspondent for Media General newspapers, writing for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, the Tampa Tribune, and the Winston-Salem Journal. I'd like to welcome club members and their guests in the audience today, as well as those of you who are watching this on C-SPAN or listening on National Public Radio or connected to the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I'd like to remind our members of some upcoming speakers. On Wednesday, October 6th, the Secretary General of NATO, Manfred Werner, will present a speech entitled "A New NATO for a New Era." And on Tuesday, October 12th, Labor Secretary Robert Reich will discuss the changing American workplace. Other upcoming luncheon speakers include the President and CEO of Amgen, Gordon Binder, and the Prime Minister of Turkey, author Stephen King, and a debate between DNC Chairman David Wilhelm and RNC Chairman Halle Barber, and the coordinator of the European Economic Community's African Elephant Project, Ian Douglas Hamilton. Audio and video tapes of Press Club luncheons are available through the National Press Club Library or by calling 1-800-952-TAPE. If you have any questions for our speaker, and I certainly trust that you will, please write them on the cards provided at your table and send them up to me, and I will ask as many as time permits. I'd like now to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly when their names are read. From your right is Lee Bowman of Scripps Howard News Service. Please. The NPC police will get you. Rick Dunham of Business Week. William Eaton of the Los Angeles Times. Robert Dodge of the Dallas Morning News. Mrs. Deborah Dingell, the wife of our speaker and president of the GM Foundation. Reginald Stewart, assistant news editor of Knight Ridder Newspapers and chairman of the National Press Club Speakers Committee. Joan Lowy, Scripps Howard News Service and the member of the Speakers Committee who arranged today's luncheon. David Everett of the Detroit Free Press. Larry Lippman of Cox Newspapers. Eileen Shanahan, not to be missed, of the St. Petersburg Times, and Peter Goslin of the Boston Globe. Ooh, that's trouble. So, now you can call. Also, I'd like to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Pat Thornsberry, and Melanie Abdu-Dermott for organizing today's luncheon. Now, I should warn you that in deference to the shy, sensitive nature of our guest speaker today, we will only allow the most polite and respectful questions. And in return, Mr. Dingell has agreed not to interrogate any members of the head table. For those Americans who are unfamiliar with Representative John Dingell of Michigan, they soon will be. As chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, he will have a major say in the coming health care debate, helping decide whether Congress follows President Clinton's plan or drafts an entirely new one of its own. Like his father before him, Mr. Dingell has been particularly concerned over the state of health care in the country. He has repeatedly introduced a plan of national health insurance that goes well beyond President Clinton's proposals. He has also aggressively investigated scientific research programs and the Environmental Protection Agency. Mr. Dingell's ancestors were blacksmiths in Poland, but the family's interests have evolved from wagon wheels to automobiles. He and his father before him have represented suburban Detroit in Congress since 1932, paying particular attention to the auto industry. To put that in perspective, Mr. Dingell's father was here for the dawn of the New Deal, and the chairman will be here, will be presiding over what some Democrats are calling the completion of the New Deal. Obviously, there's not a lot of support for term limits in that family. Mr. Dingell now stands fifth in seniority in the House, but that just begins to describe his influence. In his 12 years as chairman of the Energy and Commerce, he steadily expanded the committee's jurisdiction over the environment, health, telecommunications, insurance, financial markets, consumer protection, broadcasting, flood, food and drugs, and biotechnology. He's getting to floods next. 60% of all legislation in the House must pass through Energy and Commerce. During the most recent Congress, his committee fashioned a new energy policy, a cable re-regulation bill, and tighter control on generic drugs. In the Energy Bill and earlier Clean Air Act, Mr. Dingell went out of his way to protect the auto industry. For years, he has fought against strict mileage standards and safety legislation he thought might hurt car makers. That battle has earned him several nicknames, including Dr. Detroit. But Mr. Dingell is best known and feared as chairman of the Oversight Committee, a position he has used to investigate everything from university scientists to Air Force contracts for toilet seats, from Red Cross blood banks to bottled water. He has also peppered government agencies with thousands of Dinglegrams, demanding action or information. And for those reporters who are working on stories about bureaucratic foul-ups, Mr. Dingell's Oversight Committee offers one-stop shopping. So, ladies and gentlemen, sit back, relax, and for heaven's sake, don't make him angry. Please welcome to the National Press Club the chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, Mr. John Dingell.
Thank you, Mr. President, for a very gracious introduction. And thank you all, my friends, for a warm welcome. The lovely Deborah, who is an extraordinary woman and my favorite wife, and I are delighted to be with you today. And it is an honor to address the Press Club. And I appreciate the interest that you have in what I might say on the subject of health care reform. I suspect that many of you here are a bit tired of hearing about health care reform. And if you are, you have my sympathy, but not too much. I've been thinking, talking, or working on national health insurance for 50 years. And as man and boy, I can recall almost every one of the important events which occurred in connection with that struggle. I was a teenager in 1943 when Roosevelt was president, and a poor Polish legislator from Detroit joined with Senators Murray and Wagner to introduce the first bill on this subject. These efforts have been followed and renewed in fits and starts with success from time to time under Presidents Truman and Johnson, and even under a well-known creeping socialist by the name of Richard Milhouse Nixon. All of these efforts were doomed in good part to failure. Roosevelt had to fight a war, and he had to address the problem of an economic downturn in 1936. Truman had to fight what was then, at $25 million, the largest lobbying campaign and effort in the history of this country. Johnson had, of course, Vietnam, and Nixon, Watergate. This year, the situation is much the same, but it's also different. We have before us the chance to pass the last major component of the New Deal. And as the last remaining New Dealer in the Congress, and a second generation one at that, I am prepared to move heaven and earth in the Energy and Commerce Committee to see to it that health care reform passes. Now, I mentioned that there is similarity and difference. In this country, we still have 37 million Americans without health care. That is a national calamity. But we have something else, which finally has come to be a matter of public awareness. And that is, we are now recognizing that with health care costs doubling every 6 years, and with the health care component in an American manufactured automobile costing as much as $1,476, that we can no longer afford the current system. Indeed, had President Clinton balanced the budget in the recent fight over reconciliation and the budget proposals, in 6 years, we would find that the doubling of health care, which will occur at that time, that the budget deficit would have been bigger at the end of that 6 years than it was at the time that the President had he done so, balanced the budget of the United States. My role in this undertaking will not be to solve the public relations problem or to sell the administration's program. I am not by training, nor am I by temperament, a salesman. The President and the First Lady are their own best advocates, and each of them have done a stellar job of presenting the facts and the program to the American people and to the Congress in the last couple of weeks. My job will be to enact the plan that the President has submitted to the Congress, and that I will bring two commodities to the effort. One, political experience, and second of all, perspective. You might know that neither of these are held in great respect or regard in this country at this time. I would observe that in my experience, I have never seen so many people proclaim agreement on the need for health care reform. I am quite frankly delighted to hear the discussions of bipartisan cooperation. I am, however, a realist. And while everybody is for, and I quote, reform, close quote, today's pledges of cooperation seem to mask some very real differences. It will soon be apparent as this debate goes forward who is for and who is against health security and the real effort to absolve this country of a terrible economic, social, and humanitarian problem. And it will also become plain who is really interested in holding down costs. In other words, we will be able to separate the sheep from the goats. We'll know who believes in genuine reform and who is willing to accept the difficult choices that it entails. And then we will be able to identify those who might have more limited or perhaps different goals. The efforts of our subcommittees and committee will be focused on setting the President's goal into concrete legislation. In that regard, we will find ourselves judged against three tests. First, will good health insurance cover every American by a date certain, not at some vague point in the future, when and if politicians muster the necessary courage to finally bring that about? Second, will we achieve genuine and not theoretical cost containment, or we will just make some providers more rich and force consumers to pay more? Third, will the burdens of financing be fairly distributed? I've heard it said that we can achieve two, but not all three of these goals. This analysis reminds me of an old saw. You can get it cheap, you can get it fast, and you can get it good. Pick any two. Well, I happen to think that we can achieve all three of these goals. As we start, I see some small problem areas for the administration's proposals. First of all, its substance. Second of all, its politics. And third of all, its procedure. Other than that, I will promise you smooth sailing. I want to assure you that I'm not being facetious, but this proposal does face some serious obstacles. First, on substance. The proposal is thoughtfully conceived and carefully crafted after many months of discussion with hundreds or thousands of Americans and others, people interested in, knowledgeable in, and concerned about health care, plus other citizens. I have heard very few people actually use the word socialized medicine to this point, but I'm beginning to note that it's cropping up in editorials and elsewhere. The critics who argue this, we have heard from before. I've compiled a small list of the top 10 criticisms of the administration's proposals, and I will present them without the flair that David Letterman would use, in no particular order. First, it will force rationing. The hard fact of the matter is that this country confronts rationing of health care right at this minute. We ration between the rich and the poor, between the haves and the have-nots. Number two, it will create a two-tier system of health care. Well, the harsh fact is that we already have a two-tier system. In every nation, even nations with national health insurance, the wealthy are quite able to take care of themselves. while the balance must make do with what is available to them. Number three, it will create a massive new bureaucracy. The harsh fact here is that we have a massive healthcare bureaucracy right this minute, and it is regrettably a brainless, blind, bumbling, inefficient, and very frankly, incompetent bureaucracy. The people making this criticism evidently have never had to deal with an insurance company, a hospital billing clerk, or have never filled out a benefit form. I visited last year 6 hospitals, 2 in Canada, 4 in the United States. In Detroit, it took 60 people at each to fill out and to handle the billing and the insurance forms. In Windsor, just across the river, it took exactly 3. Every health plan has a bureaucracy. Every health plan will have a bureaucracy. The Clinton plan seeks to at least give us one which we can manage. It has been said that of the $1 trillion we spend on healthcare, about $200 billion go in billing and administration. Number four, people will lose their current coverage. This is an old hackneyed phrase that I have heard time after time. The real fact is that millions of people lose their coverage every month. 37.5 million Americans have no coverage. 76,000 in Michigan have no coverage. And 76,000 will lose their coverage this month in Michigan. Indeed, thousands are losing their coverage while I appear before you. The core of the Clinton proposal is to guarantee insurance coverage and to ensure that Americans can feel secure, that their health care program is not going to be changed, abolished, abandoned, or lost to them through any circumstance. Number five, people will no longer be able to choose their own doctors. This is patently false. Most Americans will have more rather than less choice under the president's plan. I find it strangely ironic that many of those making the claim that we will no longer be able to choose our doctors are the same people who think that we should use the device of term limitations to prevent people from choosing their own elected representatives. Number six, the financing is a fantasy. The harsh fact of the matter is that we finance healthcare today with a fantasy in which many people believe they pay nothing. Some of my colleagues are untroubled by the financing fantasies of Ronald Reagan or George Bush, but they are profoundly troubled about the proclaimed fantasies of the financing of President Clinton's health care plan. I happen to hold administrations, Republican or Democrat, to a higher standard, and I fully expect that the questions about financing will be addressed by the Congress, both by our Republican colleagues and by our Democratic colleagues, and also by the committee structure, which will seek to have a truthful answer to these questions. Number seven, small business is either gored or ignored, and I intend no pun here. The harsh fact is that under the current system, small businesses have a choice. They can go broke, or they can refuse to provide coverage. Number eight, the plan will not effectively contain costs. Curiously, this is a criticism which emanates from those who simultaneously claim that the president's plan cuts too deeply. A number of the so-called deficit hawks on both sides of the aisle for years have screamed for controls on the entitlement programs. Faced with a concrete proposal, you can observe them from the rear end traveling toward the high grass and the thick timber at a high rate of speed. Number nine, that it will restrict the delivery of services. The hard fact here is that too many of the services we receive today are thoroughly unnecessary, some to avoid medical liability questions and some, quite honestly, for different reasons which may even be less desirable. It is only a slight exaggeration to say that under the current system, emergency hospital services conduct helicopter races in Michigan to the scene of an accident, and that the cure for going broke for two competitive hospitals in Michigan is for each of them to purchase a helicopter. It is also noteworthy that many parents find that they have to do something like getting an MRI before permitting their children to play junior league soccer or football. The criticism number 10, it will inhibit the development of new medical technologies. I'm sorry. These things happen. Now, I'm not an economist, and I think that you should be pleased with that. I am also no businessman. But I will observe to you that within a competitive trillion-dollar industry, growing towards $2 trillion in 6 years, at a rate exceeding the rate of inflation, there will continue to be an enormous number of opportunities for entrepreneurs who develop breakthrough drugs, devices, and wonderful new techniques of delivery. I don't dismiss any of these criticisms. When you are restructuring a trillion-dollar industry, of course, there will be dislocations and problems. But the people criticizing this plan ought to be asked a few questions. And to all of those who are critics, let's ask these questions. How would you, Mr. Critic, end the rationing which we now have? How would you, Mr. Critic, promote fairness and equality in treatment? How, Mr. or Mrs. or Miss Critic, would you cut bureaucracy and costs? And how, Mr. or Miss or Mrs. Critic, would you help small business? How would you finance universal coverage? Do you find status quo to be an acceptable alternative? And I want to say here, I join the overwhelming number of American people in observing that the status quo is not a tolerable or an acceptable alternative, both because of cost and because of hardship. We have to depend on you in the media to insist that these questions be discussed and that these questions be answered. The second problem area for health care reform is, of course, politics. Legislation this large gives everybody a tree or a rock to hide behind. You will hear criticisms of this plan for being too ambitious. You will hear others criticizing it for not being sufficiently ambitious. Some of the really adroit spokesmen for different interests will at the same time claim that it fails to meet both concerns. You can say it caters too much to big business, that it subsidizes small business too generously. And I'd like to make a parenthetical observation. Big business is going to pay about 7.9% of payroll. Small business is going to pay about 3%. That is clearly a significant subsidy to the small business and to the employee of the small business. You can also say it favors consumers at the expense of providers, or you can say that it provides subsidy and comfort to providers at the expense of consumers. And some, as I've mentioned, will use all of these, sometimes almost in the same breath. Lyndon Johnson used to tell the story of a teacher who went to a job interview and was asked whether he thought the world was round or flat, and how did he teach that subject. The teacher said, "I am a professional. I can teach it either way." Washington is full of lobbyists, public relations specialists, and others, and they are prepared to teach it either way, round or flat, and they are looking forward to a highly prosperous year with many billable hours. But while it may be a fine time to be a Washington consultant, it is also a wonderful time to be a citizen of the greatest nation in the world. It is interesting to note that very little criticism has come of statements which have made the point that our system is broke, it needs fixing, and that we need universal coverage for every American, that we have to contain costs and do all of the other things which the President has been referring to. And the difference seems to lie mostly not in whether something has to be done, but in precisely what it is that and how it is that we will address the concerns and the situation that we confront. You know that when you see my colleagues on both sides of the aisle speaking as they have, you know that the President has tapped deeply into public sentiment, and that members of Congress are, as they always do, listening to their constituents. Now, this brings me down to one of the important questions, because if you've observed over my career, I've always observed that the question of procedure was the most important situation that you confront in terms of handling legislation. The legislation, when it arrives, can be referred to as many as 16 committees. We are already reading in the press and hearing in the media about internecine jurisdictional wrangling. Well, that is the committee system at work. And in point of fact, it is good, because you want to have your legislation considered in your Congress carefully and thoughtfully, giving full attention and full opportunity to the concerns of every American. Many of the sounds that you hear with regard to jurisdiction are just nothing more or less than posturings. The divisions on this issue, which are being announced between the Committee on Energy and Commerce and the Committee on Ways and Means and the Committee on Education and Labor, or between the Senate Finance and Senate Labor Committees, are really not the question of real concern about whether we are going to get a bill or not. There are really just two groups in this debate: those who really want a bill and those who do not. Jurisdictional disputes are not now and will not be an impediment to this legislation. I do have, as you know, my own views of jurisdiction, and I have sought to do what Sam Rayburn used to do in terms of protecting the jurisdiction of what I regard as the greatest committee in the Congress. It is a committee which, as you know, has 200 years of experience in all manner of legislative issues, including the subject of health. It also has more than a modest amount of experience in dealing with extremely complex legislation. And I can tell you that our committee is, of course, prepared to lead on the handling of this legislation. But we are not going to seek pride of place or position. We want a bill. The substantive, political, and procedural obstacles, as we have noted earlier, me and my comments and you with your chuckle, are enormous. Together, they pose a severe test for the Congress. This legislative battle will be unlike any that my colleagues and I have dealt with during my career. For one thing, we have a system of enormous complexity. It is one which touches the lives of 1 in 7 of the workers in this country, because it touches their jobs. It also touches $1 in 7 in the economy. It also touches every man, woman, and child in this society, because everyone has real reasons to complain about the health care system. But we have something good going for us. We have a president, for the first time in 12 years, who is willing and able to accept the responsibility for governing. He has come forward with the first major affirmative domestic proposal in 12 years. Our freshmen, our newer members, and even some of the not-so-new members have never served with an activist president before. Health care reform is going to severely test the ability of the nation to arrive at a consensus on complex issues. It is going to test the Congress. It is going to test the administration. And I hope that you understand that it is going to test each of you and all of you as the media, because you have a real stake in this question. This is your country. This is a matter which desperately affects the present and the future well-being of the people of this country, and it is an issue which desperately touches the future of the country itself because of the massive cost increases that we will be undergoing in health care if we don't do something to bring it under control. The issue has the potential of making the clean air fight look like a commemorative stamp resolution. It is going to test, as I mentioned, the ability of the Congress to serve the public interest. Now, is the Congress going to receive a great deal of credit? Probably not. We usually don't. You are not the first generation of Americans in the media to castigate the Congress at every opportunity. You will recall that a great Oklahoma wit once observed that there was no native criminal class in the United States except the Congress. Now, the Congress can, and I hope will, make bold choices in this matter. It is fair to observe that we cannot satisfy everyone. If cost containment works, providers will be unhappy. If a service, needed or not, is a bit harder to get, reform will be blamed. Further, there are problems that go beyond the reach of any legislation. The population is aging. The costs of technology are growing faster than our income. And the government has only limited means to influence the personal behavior of our citizens. In one sense, it is unrealistic to expect that the Congress will get credit. The present course, with costs doubling every 6 years, is, as I have mentioned to you, a road towards a howling disaster. I am not aware that you or I or anyone gets credit from our car insurance for avoiding a collision. Had the Congress and the administration had the courage to restructure the savings and loan industry in 1983, we would have avoided $500 billion drain on the taxpayers and the Treasury. And we would, however, if you look at the history of that, probably been saddled with more criticism than praise in connection with that undertaking. Having said all of this, I am optimistic about our prospects. Not just optimistic, but wildly optimistic, even though at this time I have taken no vote counts. The process is just beginning. The administration has shown and announced a measure of flexibility. And all of us who will be handling this legislation will probably have to call in some favors. And I suspect we will have to also twist a few arms. I continue to believe that the best long-term course and prospect for covering every American with health insurance and controlling costs is the single-payer system. It works in Britain, it works in Canada. But I also know something else that was told me by an old friend by the name of Manny Seller, and that is that the perfect enemy can be, and probably in this instance would be, the enemy of the good. This is our first and best opportunity to pass national health insurance in the more than 50 years since its first introduction. I am a patient man. I have waited this long, and I will wait another 50 years, even if it takes a medical miracle to be around when we finally do adopt this proposal. I am not counting on a medical miracle. I am counting on the American people, the Congress of the United States, the goodwill of the media, and your efforts to see to it that the matter is fairly reported. And then I think that the political miracle will occur in the 103rd Congress, and that before the 104th convenes, we will be able to congratulate ourselves that we have done something good for the country and something good for the people, perhaps the greatest good that has been accomplished in the memories of all of us. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dingell. You have answered a lot of the questions before I could ask them. There was a lot of questions about your advocacy of the single-payer system versus the managed competition that the president comes up with. Do you see with the president's proposal as a way station towards a single-member or single-member district, a single-payer system sometime down the road? Is this just an interim step to getting to a full government-run health system?
It is possible, but I think we should address this in the light of its own worth or lack of worth. Is this a system which is going to make the country better? Is this a system which is going to reduce costs? Is this a system which is going to increase coverage to every American? Is this a system which will give security to the American people, which they now lack? Very frankly, it took us 50 years from the time that Franklin Delano Roosevelt first talked about this matter back in 1936 to get us to where we are today. I don't think that there will be an enormous rush to make changes in a system which is going to undergo a period of years and which will probably take as much as 5 to 7 years to finally be put largely in place.
Given the intra-party divisions on the path to reform, a single pair of proponents, conservative Democrats who want pure competition, what road do you think President Clinton should take to achieve a bipartisan compromise?
Well, there are two questions that I always get as I'm dealing with legislation. The first is when, and the second is how. And no legislator knows the answer to either one of these questions. And if he tells you that he knows the answer at this phase in the proceedings, you should immediately doubt either his sanity or his veracity. Having said that, there will be a lot of negotiations. The one thing about the Congress and the legislative process is that it is, as Bismarck observed, a very untidy process, and you shouldn't watch the making of either sausages or legislation if you like either one of these commodities. But the hard fact is that it is a process which works to establish legislation which meets the national consensus and the consensus of the elected representatives of the people. We, I think, will achieve that. Precisely how or exactly when, I can't tell you, although it is my feeling we will do so before the end of this Congress.
This questioner asks, what would Clinton's program do to the insurance industry, and do you care?
I'll answer the second part first. Yes, I care. I was not sent down here to destitute my district or any other district or to cost jobs or opportunities to the people or the industries of this country. I see that the healthcare alliances which will be set up will be contracting with providers. Those providers will be essentially either hospitals, HMOs, or insurance plans which will give choice as we now know it. I think that there will be a place, a very real place, for the continued sale of responsible insurance companies, of responsible insurance products. Now, there are some things that will probably come to a halt, and I don't think that you will see a teary eye in this room over those things. The first will, of course, be the cherry pickers and the cream skimmers. Clearly, there is a real problem with a system where products are priced to meet narrow segments of the market, which cost little to the provider and which give little benefit to the buyer at prices which are excessively high. Those we will bid farewell to with minimum regret. But for the rest of responsible insurance and insurance products, they will be on the market and will be participants in this program. And I happen to think that that's a good thing.
Should Congress hold a health care summit to work out a bill?
Well, we will hold a series of them. There will be summits in each of the committees. There will be a summit on the floor of the House and the Senate. And there will be a summit when we have the conference meet. It may be that at some process as the events go forward, we will have to have some other side discussions, perhaps involving the top leadership in either the House or in the Senate or in both bodies. But a planned summit is, I think, not necessary, given the fact that the committee system was roughly designed to bring that exact process about.
Well, inside baseball here, how will jurisdictional issues over health care reform be resolved? For example, Ways and Means versus Commerce versus Education and Labor?
Well, the Speaker will be will be assigning those responsibilities under the rules of the House. We think that they can be respected. There will be, you're talking about here, a very large bill in terms just of the amount of paper or the length or the size of the legislation. And there, it will have many sections, probably a goodly number of titles, some of which will be referred to one committee or another. One of my efforts will be to do, as I have always done when we are referred legislation which we share with other committees, is to simply tell the members that they may not offer amendments which will relate to the business of other committees. And of course, I will hope that the other chairman will do exactly the same thing. I am not troubled about the jurisdictional questions. The speaker will assign the bill either in entirety or in parts to the different committees. And I would anticipate there will be other committees that will also be addressing these questions. I think that there will be antitrust questions, which will probably go to the Judiciary Committee. I suspect that there will be questions relative to veterans hospitals, which may very well go to the Veterans Committee. I would suspect that we will see questions which will be associated with other matters which will go to still other committees. And I want to reiterate to you that, as Woodrow Wilson observed, the committee system is the Congress at work. And having the kind of expertise that is brought by the several committees to these questions will be not only important, but valuable.
This question wants to know, is it fair for younger big corporations to have to absorb, through the co-ops, the higher health care costs of older big corporations with older workers and retirees, companies like Ford, GM, and Chrysler?
Anybody know of a younger big corporation who's going to get that break? One of the things that we have been seeing in this country over time is that we have gone to, quote, experience rating, close quote, instead of community rating. It's resulting in some rather appalling situations in terms of the way the health care bills of this country and the costs are apportioned. And it tends to afflict not only the little business, and I'm talking about 3 to 50 or 100 or 200 employees, who oftentimes pay as much as 30% more than does a larger corporation, or how much, or it will affect some of the large corporations in similar fashion. Having said those things, if you look, you will find that GM, Ford, and Chrysler are doing pretty well because they are large enough to negotiate out fairly good deals with their different carriers. You will also find that many of these corporations now and under the legislation also have the option to essentially be pretty much self-insured. So these are, I would not be much troubled about the unfairness of this. You're going to find that community rating carries with it a very, very real advantage for every corporation, large or small, or indeed for the individuals.
This question wants to know, how do you view the Clintons' proposal to allow corporations with more than 5,000 workers to continue to operate their own plans, but charge them a 1% payroll tax anyway? Is this fair? What will it do to the auto industry?
Well, A, it's fair. B, it will help the auto industry. C, it will help a lot of other industries. D, I think it's a pretty good proposal.
Well, that's unequivocal. Are the health care provisions to let government pay some health care costs of early retirees a bailout for big business? How would you characterize this expensive proposition?
Well, it's going to cost money, but it is not going to happen without the corporations making some payment for the benefit which they achieve. Very frankly, some years ago, I went up to New York to talk to the Business Roundtable. Some of my friends who were there are with us at this particular minute. And we talked about what the healthcare situation was. And we talked about how healthcare is now breaking American corporations. I mentioned that an American automobile has $1,476 worth of health care in it, in an automobile, and that is more than the steel, and that the biggest contractors of the American auto industry are not the steel companies, but rather it is the insurers and the health care providers. Having said those things, I personally think it's a pretty good idea. It makes the United States competitive, and I believe that this can be done within the savings that we can achieve elsewhere in the plan.
One reporter passed up a note asking for a clarification. Just to be clear, although you favor single payer, you will support the Clinton managed competition plan.
Yes, with great enthusiasm.
That's clear. Under the Clinton administration's managed care health proposals, won't people with higher incomes still be able to purchase health insurance policies which will enable them to receive more and better health care benefits? If so, won't we have the same basic health industry geared to those who can afford it, who can afford the best medical care?
Well, the answer to the question is yes. Will people who have higher incomes and the ability to purchase additional supplemental plans be able to do so? Yes, and absolutely they should. They do it. They are able to do so in every country in the world which has a system of this kind. And remember, this is all about choice. The idea is not to provide total care, but to provide an adequate system of health care for everyone, and to preserve to the fullest degree possible for both the patient and for the doctor the amount of choice which the best amount of choice which we can give to him or her.
Just on taxes, the healthcare proposal is mostly looking at increasing the cigarette tax to pay for as the revenue increase for this. If this had been a gasoline tax, would you be as favor as, or an auto a tax on new cars, would you have been as much in favor of it?
Well, as a matter of fact, if it had been a tax on gasoline, which was fair as a tax on tobacco is, yes.
do you think that there should be some kind of alcohol tax on a liquor tax on this?
Well, you know, one of the things that nobody in this room will believe, but I do try and stay within the jurisdiction of our committee, and in perfect truth, this is Mr. Ross Dukowski's problem.
Now, your oversight committee is always pointing out how bureaucracy is just fouled up one side and down the other. Why would you favor creating a larger new bureaucracy if one is the one we have is not all that good?
Well, let's take a look at it. First of all, we're not trading for a larger bureaucracy for a smaller bureaucracy. You have an enormous bureaucracy dealing with healthcare right this minute. But let's take a look at efficiency. Medicare and Social Security collect money and disperse it at about 1.5%. A highly efficiently run American industrial healthcare program functions at 8%. A less efficient one does so as high as 14%. We have run some investigations of different kinds of health care insurance, and we have found that in some instances, the benefits that reached the people who bought those policies ran as low as 25%, with 75% being overhead. Now, those were extraordinary, but they go on. They were clearly scams, but they give you an idea that perhaps maybe government collection and payment for programs of this sort is not a bad idea, nor is it inefficient. Now, I want to add to that one other thought. A lot of people are calling this socialized medicine. I would urge you to go to look at the nearest dictionary or encyclopedia and you will find that socialism is government ownership of the means of production. This is not government ownership of the means of production, and it is therefore not socialized medicine. What we are doing is setting up a mechanism to provide for an orderly system of payment of health care costs, to abate the inefficiencies now in the system, and to see to it that the maximum of security and choice exists for both people in the industry and people who would be recipients of the services of the industry. Those things are extremely important to keep in mind. I would beg you to understand that you will probably see less rather than more bureaucracy. And I've told you the story of the hospitals where I found in Canada, they have three. In the US, they have 60 people doing billing. And when you make your next visit to your doctor's office, look at all those wonderful people, men and women, dressed in white, and come to the thought that these are not necessarily nurses who are there to look after your health, nor are they paramedics. They are simply people who are doing billing. At this minute, we have some 1,500 different insurers in this country who are selling uncounted thousands of different policies to industries, to individuals, to provide for health care. Some of those will, of course, go. But we have every reason to assume that with additional competition will come additional efficiencies, and that the financing mechanism, we will finally know, in fact, does work efficiently.
Well, we've been talking about health care a lot, but there are people who acknowledge that you do other things besides health care, and they have a lot of questions. This question wants to know, do you and Mr. Brooks plan to sponsor a telecommunications bill this year? What is the status of the negotiations? And will it act to ensure that smaller telecommunications companies have an active role in shaping the information superhighway?
Okay. Mr. Brooks and I are negotiating. Our negotiations so far have been very successful. We are down to a few small issues. We think that we will achieve the resolution of them very shortly. And we think that this will lead to the co-sponsorship by the two of us of a piece of legislation which will address some of the questions now involved in the overall pattern of telecommunications, with very specific emphasis on resolution of the controversies now swirling around under through the matters before Judge Green involving newspapers and the baby bells. We think that we will be able to address many of the questions there, and we are hopeful that when we do so, we can get the issue resolved quickly.
There's been some interest from Detroit wanting to know, what do you think of the government Big Three announcement to develop a clean car?
Well, that is something which was negotiated by and between the companies and the government. I will tell you that I had a few modest interests in those matters, and I will tell you that I made some suggestions to both the government and to the companies. But the negotiations were theirs entirely, and I have seen some of the documents in earlier stages on that matter. And if it satisfies the companies, and if the government will honor it and the agreements which were made there, I suspect I will be satisfied.
Most importantly, this questioner asks, does this supercar plan remove the need for automotive fuel economy legislation?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
It appears the Joint Committee on Congressional Reform will recommend substantial realignment of committee jurisdiction in the House. Will you fight this recommendation?
Well, we're always willing to accept more jurisdiction on the Commerce Committee. We'll have to see what they said. I would hope that the individual who submitted that to that question would appears to have some knowledge of about the situation that I lack, would come forward and let me know, because obviously they're going to come to the right judgment there and recognize that we do our business well on the Commerce Committee. both in terms of moving legislation and also in terms of, quite honestly, overseeing the fact that the legislation is properly administered. But having said this, in the event that you're aware of any backsliding or any bad judgments that might be coming forward, I'd appreciate if you'd come forward immediately after the dinner and tell me about it, because if this thing's going to be fought, I want to be one of those who's going to do it.
And a quick NAFTA question. What can you predict about congressional action on NAFTA? When and what will be the outcome?
Well, congressional action on NAFTA is being withheld at this minute, in good part because the administration does not have the votes. I can't tell you when they will get the votes. I am, by the way, the only Michigan Democrat who is not actively in opposition to this proposal. I have some reservations about it, and I am waiting to see whether the administration will be able to address the concerns I have with regard to the side agreement. When the administration will finally get the votes and call for the legislation, I can't tell you. At this particular minute, it is very plain, and the president has so indicated, they do not now have the votes.
Before asking the last question, I'd like to present you with this wonderful certificate of appreciation for appearing here.
Thank you. Is that good? Is this good for a good editorial in the Wall Street Journal?
To get you a free drink at the bar.
Oh.
And also, despite the fact that General Colin Powell made snoots about our mug, we're even going to give you a mug.
Thank you.
This is our new and improved mug.
Thank you. It's a very handsome one.
Well, that makes you a lot more popular around here than the general was. Now, sir, knowing the high regard with which you hold your colleagues in the other body, do you have any interest in running for the Senate now that there is an open seat from your state?
Well, I've struggled for a long time to get to be chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee, and I'm really not interested in any demotions at this time.
Thank you very much, sir.